This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our show Main Street because our microphones create a Main Street, a virtual one, all across the state this time of day. The real ones are out there that are the jewels of our communities. We meet and greet our friends and neighbors and talk about what's on our minds, you know, share our news and opinions, and maybe look down that Main Street and reflect on how things have changed over the years. Change is a constant. Consider the change to North Dakota's economy. A decade into North Dakota's shale fracking boom, the state consistently produces 1 million barrels of oil per day. That amount is second only to Texas, making North Dakota a huge player, not just on the national oil scene, but globally as well. And the governor is dreaming even bigger. He wants to double North Dakota's daily oil production. Inside Energy's Amy Sisk looks at how the state arrived at 1 million barrels and what it will take to get to the next million.
To tell this story of the Bakken's evolution, I'm at the state capitol in Bismarck, walking up the marble steps. It's Governor Doug Burgum who has set a goal of extracting 2 million barrels of oil per day out of the Bakken. But I'm actually here to talk with his deputy, one with his own history in the oil patch.
Nice to meet you.
Good meeting, Brent Sanford.
Yeah, Amy, sis.
Come on back.
Before he became lieutenant governor, Brent Sanford was the mayor of Watford City. It's a small town that's at the epicenter of the state's oil activity. Back around 2004, he noticed something interesting.
There was a buzz, and there hadn't been a buzz in the air for 15 years, I would say, in that area. It was pretty depressing after the second oil boom had basically gone away in the late 80s.
See, right across the border in Montana, oil companies were trying out this new technology. Not only were they drilling deep into the earth, but they were turning the drill horizontally through shale rock. They sent a mixture of water and chemicals and sand into the well at a high pressure to perforate that rock and release the oil. This was hydraulic fracturing. It took 3 years for this new drilling method to move into North Dakota, jumping across the border to an oil field 100 miles away. No one could predict what was in store. Kathy Nesset was there.
I remember companies saying, oh my goodness, you know, there's nothing in between.
In between Montana's new fracked wells and drilling activity on the eastern edge of North Dakota's oil fields.
Well, here we are, you know, what are we, 10, 11 years later, and there's, you know, there's a whole world of Bakken in between.
Nesset is a geologist and the owner of Nesset Consulting. It was around that time that her geological expertise became really in demand. She was working out of her farmhouse.
Then around 2005, realized we needed to get a little more space, you know, taking up the dining room table with all my files and everything.
Now they're in a 28,000-square-foot facility with an office staff of 25, plus 80 or so geologists working on rig sites. Drilling started to take off 10 years ago, but there was a problem. Not enough supporting infrastructure to transport the oil or to capture the excess natural gas. There were trucks everywhere. Here's Sanford again, talking about Watford City.
You would drive in from one of the river valleys on the side, the south or the west or the north, and you'd basically know you're there from the cloud of dust.
Now, thousands of miles of pipeline carry oil and gas and wastewater where they need to go. In 2014, North Dakota's oil industry reached that million-barrel-a-day milestone. But then, partly because of shale plays like the Bakken, the world's supply of oil skyrocketed and the price of oil collapsed. Still, production here has hovered around that 1 million mark. Now, the governor wants to see it go much, much higher.
Looking out about 10 years from now, production in the Bakken would still be at about 1.5 million barrels per day.
Jenna Delaney is an oil analyst with S&P Global Platts. Her prediction of 1.5 million is if North Dakota continues drilling at the rate it has the past few months. It isn't quite the governor's goal, but it's still a significant jump from where we are today. And she says that is the direction she sees it headed.
Really, ultimately, what happens with those prices will drive how many wells come online each month.
The price of oil has been climbing this year, and she sees it increasing slightly into 2018. Technology will also play a role. Nesset, the geologist, says 10 years ago, companies could extract only 4% of the oil stored in shale rock. Today, it's more like 8%.
You know, that means that there's 92% of the oil that we know is in the rock we can't get out yet. We don't have the technology to extract that. So I think the real future of this whole play, you know, is before us.
But there's always the potential for a curveball. It could be environmental regulations from a future presidential administration that's not so fossil fuel friendly. Or it could be a drop-off in demand for oil as industries like electric cars take off. Lieutenant Governor Sanford knows this is a possibility.
It just seems like it's a goal to not have as much reliance on petroleum.
Another challenge is infrastructure. Right now, the state has more than enough pipelines to carry its oil to market. This cheap transportation method is making Bakken crude more competitive with Texas oil. But should the state climb above 1.3 million barrels per day, it will max out its pipelines. Oil analyst Delaney says it would then lose that competitive edge.
Then we'll either need to see more pipeline projects proposed to move more of this crude oil, or we'll see more barrels moving back onto rail.
This will require oil companies to plan carefully so the Bakken is ready for its second decade. For Inside Energy, I'm Amy Sisk.
Inside Energy is a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. And we're sad to say that Amy Sisk is leaving us for a job in Pennsylvania. Her last day on the job for us was Friday. And Amy visited with Director of Radio Bill Thomas about her time reporting in North Dakota. She was hired just before a historic and busy time for energy development in the state.
It absolutely has. So I started this job in June of 2016, so about a year and a half ago, and started this job and had a couple months, you know, where I was learning the ropes of radio because I was brand new to radio reporting. And then the Dakota Access Pipeline protests hit, and that kept me really, really busy reporting for about 8 months straight.
You were super busy. How many hours a week do you think you were putting in?
I don't know. I think some weeks it was probably 80 hours. And I'll tell you what, I actually pulled my first ever all-nighter covering the pipeline protests. I stayed awake one day for 24 hours and 15 minutes working, got about an hour and a half of sleep, and then was back at work the next morning at 7. It was crazy.
Yeah, you got sick?
I did get sick for about a month and took a couple days off, but then was back at work. And finally, a month later, still didn't feel better and got some antibiotics. And then I was all good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good thing we have health insurance with this job.
Exactly.
So obviously that was so intense to just come in and so soon after starting here and being new to radio reporting and everything, covering the Dakota Access Pipeline. What are some of like the memorable stories you have from your reporting?
Yeah, so definitely covering the pipeline was probably like the most significant thing I felt I did here. But, you know, pipeline aside, I would say, you know, some of the stories that I've done out covering oil here in North Dakota have definitely been memorable. So one story that I did, I went up to the older oil fields in North Dakota, kind of up in the Bottineau, the north central part of the state. And I did a story. There's some researchers and the state is looking at trying to clean up these old brine pits. So what happened back a couple of decades ago, so today we inject this wastewater that's produced alongside with oil. We inject it underground, but a couple decades ago, they just dumped it into pits on farmers' land. And landowners in North Dakota know this very well, that brine it totally wrecks the land. And so the salt water had seeped outside of the parameters of some of those ponds where they had dumped it, and still has ruined the land today. And so I went up there, did a story about that. They're working on trying to clean up that land. I actually tasted the salt because there's salt on the surface of the land there. It's just table salt. Tastes just like it.
Wow.
But that was pretty crazy.
Yeah, yeah. You know, one of the things that our listeners to Prairie Public might not realize, but covering the Dakota Access Pipeline, you ended up being involved in a lot of different media. I remember talking to you, Amy, one time, and your phone rang or you got a text or something, and you looked down. It's like, oh, it's the New York Times. You know, it's like, I was like, it's the New York Times. You know?
So this was crazy. My background, I was a newspaper reporter before this job. And I took this job, the pipeline protests broke, and I was covering this news not only for Prairie Public and Inside Energy, but also for NPR. And that kept me crazy busy. I mean, I think I filed over 50 stories for the national network for NPR. Well, then the New York Times calls me, and they said, hey, we really need somebody to report the story for us who's in North Dakota, because they did not have a reporter based here. And I basically had to tell the New York Times no. And that was crazy because that was a long time dream of mine to work for a big major newspaper, but I didn't have the time to do it.
Yeah, you didn't have much time. And, you know, one of the things I want to ask you about is you mentioned that when we hired you here at Prairie Public for this Inside Energy job, you really were basically a newspaper person,
yep.
not an electronic media person. How was that, like, switching gears from print to radio and even some video stuff?
So it was definitely a learning curve because my background, I went through journalism school, and I think I produced one little audio story when I was a freshman in college with a really cheap little recorder. I really didn't know what I was doing when I started this job. But luckily, between Dave Thompson, our news director here at Prairie Public, and then my Inside Energy coworkers, I learned, you know, how to use all of my gear. And I have to say, I love radio reporting. It's a lot. It's a different way of storytelling than print, because you always have to be listening. You always have to be listening for sounds that are happening around you, you know, whether it's the waves of the Missouri River crashing up against the banks, or, you know, people chanting at these pipeline protests. You always have to be listening for that sound and capture it so that you can put it into your story. And I think it's really fun because I get to follow people around with this big microphone, and I kind of feel like I'm stalking them. I just sort of follow them wherever they go and record their footsteps and record them opening doors and record our conversation. And I actually get to be a part of a lot of the stories that I report.
Uh-huh.
That's something we do in radio reporting that's different, is often the reporter themselves will, you know, they'll be a little bit of first person in the story, which is fun.
I've heard a lot of ideas and explications about what's special about radio. I never heard that it was the medium of stalking. So that's
exactly
a good one to be aware of. Okay. It is really different from writing. And even though you write out a lot of the things you're going to say, you are doing it, you know, there's a different approach when you're doing it for the ear.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the key differences, too, is that with print journalism, you're always packing lots of little details into your stories. And with radio, I mean, we try to be as detailed as possible, but you're actually really trying to describe what's happening in a situation. So you're actually trying to set the scene rather than put tons of little nitty gritty details into your stories, because that often bogs them down, and we want to keep them engaging. So that's what I try to do.
Mm-hmm. Amy is going to another media job. She's going to be working with a state network in Pennsylvania. And you're doing energy reporting for them, right?
I will be, yes. So I'm moving to Pittsburgh, and I'm going to be working for the public radio station there, which is WESA. And then I'm also going to be a part of this group of journalists called State Impact Pennsylvania. And it's very similar to this Inside Energy project that we have here at Prairie Public. It's a collaboration between the public media stations all throughout Pennsylvania. And they have reporters at each station that cover energy out there. So they're expanding that project and hiring a reporter in Pittsburgh, and that's the job that I'll be doing. And so out in Pennsylvania, it's kind of a similar energy landscape to North Dakota, to be honest. They don't have tons of oil there, but they have natural gas. That's a huge industry with the Marcellus Shale out there. They also have a coal industry, and they have a growing renewables industry. Not quite to the extent that North Dakota has. You know, we have wind farms everywhere in our state now. I don't think Pennsylvania is quite like that yet, but I know that they have been adding wind and solar.
When you get to Pennsylvania and they ask you, like, well, what's North Dakota like? What are you going to say?
I mean, it's really cold, especially this time of year. And but I mean, the thing that I love about North Dakota is I feel like
the most hospitable people I've ever met in my life are here in North Dakota. I'm not a native North Dakotan. I'm from Seattle originally, and I just feel so at home here. I've met some really great folks here in Bismarck, and especially as I'm out around the state traveling, you just meet the nicest people that welcome you into their homes and into their businesses, and I love that about this state.
Yes, we're really sorry to have you leaving, and it's because we're losing funding for the Inside Energy Project, but we're trying to find new funding and hoping to have somebody back in Amy's position before too long. So, Amy, I got to ask you some questions about, you know, kind of your most extreme experiences here. You know, when were you the most scared? What was the most exciting story? What's the weirdest thing that happened to you while you were reporting around North Dakota or in the studio, whatever.
Yeah. Okay, let me tell you a funny story here. So this is a little behind-the-scenes story.
Okay.
So often what NPR will do, like on Morning Edition or All Things Considered, is they'll often air stories from reporters around the country, but they'll also interview reporters, kind of like we're doing now. So I would have one of their hosts interviewing me. And so one morning, it was back when I was covering the pipeline protests, and there had been some major development with the pipeline. I can't remember what it was. But the next morning, David Green, one of the Morning Edition hosts, was going to do a live interview with me. And this was the very first story to air on Morning Edition that day, like the most important story in the country, apparently.
Yes, that lead position.
Yes. And so it was 4 a.m., and I woke up about 3:30 that morning because this was live, and we were talking via Skype. So I was actually at my house, not in the studio. And so we were on Skype, and we hadn't started the interview yet. But I have this cat, and this cat loves to meow. And he would not stop meowing. And I'm just like, shoot, how am I going to get through this interview about this very serious subject, this huge national news, with my cat meowing in the background? The entire nation is going to hear my cat. So what I did really quick
was... Your cat probably knew that. That's why your cat
exactly
was pushing.
And so I ran downstairs and I found some catnip, and I just sprinkled catnip all over my rug, and my little cat Olaf just started rolling around in it, and he was quiet. And I did the interview. He did not meow, and all was good.
Oh, important things to know to keep in your reporter's kit.
Exactly. And yeah. I have used that trick multiple times since.
Yeah, if you have to do it from home, it can be tricky. What about, the kind of scariest thing that's happened?
You know, I think the scariest moment that I've had in this job, there were a couple of times when I was covering the pipeline protests. Number one, that I was afraid I might be arrested.
Oh, yeah.
That happened once where I was in a group of protesters and the police told everybody to leave, and none of the protesters were leaving. And there was this huge line of police in their riot gear kind of surrounding us, and I wasn't going to leave either because my story was right there and we were on public property. But luckily, they ended up not arresting folks, and I was fine. That happened. There were a couple other times when I was afraid covering those protests that I was going to be, pepper sprayed or get sprayed with tear gas because the police had these big canisters, you know, as they were monitoring the protests. I think the scariest thing, though, one time I was down near these pipeline protest camps, and it was late at night, about 10:30 p.m., and I had never seen the camps at night before. And so I drove up there because I was staying at the casino to report for a couple of days. And I drove up, pulled over on the side of the road, and got out, took a picture with my phone, and got back in. And I was trying to send out a tweet because it was the one spot down there where I was kind of on top of a hill. So there was like one bar of cell service. And this car pulls up next to me, and there's like these three burly guys. And this guy gets out of the car, and he like demands that I roll down my window and demands to know who I am. And this was a guy who was, acting kind of as a security guard for the camp down there. And so he demanded to see my driver's license and my business card. Uh-huh. And I just got really scared because, you know, I was all alone out there with like these three tough guys. Luckily, they let me go and everything was fine. But it was kind of an interrogation, and decided that I wasn't going to be down there alone at night by myself again.
Huh. I'm curious just to get your opinion. You can be a commentator instead of a reporter here for a second. You've been covering energy very intensively in North Dakota for many months. What do you think? What do you think is in store for North Dakota?
Yeah, so let's take oil first, because that's kind of our biggest energy industry here. I was just talking with an oil analyst the other day and about this exact subject, where is oil headed in North Dakota? And she said, you know, definitely over the next few years, she sees production increasing here. We've seen the price of oil climb this past year, and it's almost up to $60 a barrel, which is kind of the sweet spot that the industry really wants in order to really start drilling again. And so I can see that production continuing to increase in the coming years. And then, you know, I think let's take the coal industry next. The coal industry nationwide is really kind of struggling right now because we've seen a huge increase in natural gas producing electricity as well as renewables, and that's competing with coal. Now, North Dakota's a bit insulated. North Dakota's coal industry is a bit insulated from that because we have lignite coal here. And lignite is a very heavy type of coal, and it can't be transported long distances because it's so heavy. And so because of that, companies save on transportation costs, and it's a bit cheaper to burn here. And so it's a bit insulated from some of those pressures, but I think
so
that...
You think coal is going to be struggling? Because, you know, we've seen things in the legislature, people being pretty defensive toward the coal industry.
Yeah, here. We definitely have. And so I think those pressures are starting to be felt here. It's just taken a while for those pressures to be felt here, whereas the rest of the country was already feeling those pressures, you know, a couple years ago. And then, you know, the other big energy industry we have here is wind and renewables. And I see that just continuing to grow. You know, 10 years ago, North Dakota produced only 2% of its electricity from wind. And today, 10 years later, we're at 22%. And that is just a huge growth. And I imagine that that will continue.
Any commentary on alcohol or biodiesel, those things? What do you have an opinion about that?
You know, I haven't done tons of reporting on those particular areas, but, you know, those industries probably will continue here.
Did you learn any special new dishes or tastes while you were in North Dakota?
I absolutely did. So every Thanksgiving, I now make lefse. And it usually tastes pretty good. Now, I don't have all the proper tools that you're supposed to use to make lefse. I don't have a lefse griddle. Instead, I use this panini maker griddle, and it's not quite ideal, but it does work. But I did get a lefse stick at Husfest.
Husfest?
Yeah, a year or two ago. So.
Okay. Well, you'll have to add Kuchen to that soon. So.
Exactly. I love Kuchen. I just have never made it before.
Uh-huh. Okay. Amy, thank you so much for your work here with Prairie Public. It's been a tremendous contribution for our listeners to have so much more deep and extensive coverage of what's going on in energy, and you've really done a great job for us, so we really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Phil. It's been a lot of fun.
Amy Sisk, formerly North Dakota's reporter for Inside Energy, talking with our Bill Thomas. Coming up on Main Street, we'll check in with John Ford Dunker, who moved from North Dakota to Brooklyn to pursue a career in entertainment and who last week was getting laughs on the Conan O'Brien show. And we'll check in with the man who's driving a big rig from Montana to Washington, D.C. with the Capitol Christmas tree. That's coming up on Main Street. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Water rescue teams from Grand Forks and Stutzman County in North Dakota are being asked to assist in the search for two Red Lake, Minnesota fishermen who went missing last week. The Red Lake Department of Public Safety made the mutual aid request because of changing ice conditions that make access to the lake by boat very difficult. Lieutenant B.J. Maxson of the Grand Forks Sheriff's Department says the Northeast Regional Water Rescue Team will utilize airboats and drivers in the recovery efforts. Maxson says the team is trained for ice rescue and diving.
When the diver goes down, if anything happens or he gets tangled up or something, there's a way to, you know, find out where he is. And also those ropes help him come back and find the hole that's in the ice.
Maxson says Stutzman County also has a remote operating vehicle that will be a big help.
Drop it through the hole in the ice, and you can remotely drive it to look around. That way the diver's not down there getting caught up in whatever is down there, and you're still able to cover a very, very good amount of area.
Two fishermen, ages 29 and 17, have been missing since their boat capsized 1 week ago. A 32-year-old member of the party was able to swim to shore. The local water rescue team will travel to Red Lake today and begin search operations tomorrow morning. The State Racing Commission takes up requests for 2018 race dates when it meets tomorrow. The North Dakota Horse Park in Fargo wants 7 race days on weekends in July. That's one day less than this year. Director Gunnar LaCour says than last year. Director Gunnar LaCour says they tried several 3-day weekends this year, but the results were not as good as expected. Overall, attendance was down slightly, but financially, the track came out okay.
Financially, still crossing some T's and dotting some I's, but it looks like it was fine financially. I don't think Fridays were necessarily the boon that we had hoped for. And that plays into a lot of these considerations. Attendance and handle or wagering wise, things were pretty much on par with the year before. But again, that's spread over more days.
LaCour says the track has made significant progress since 2015, when race dates were revoked by the Racing Commission and it had to reorganize. In 2016, attendance was up and came close to setting a wagering record over its 6-day run. The requested 2018 race dates are July 14th and 15th, July 20th, 21st, and 22nd, and July 27th and 28th. That weekend coincides with the Fargo Air Show, and LaCour says that could draw some attendees to the horse races. And Bismarck-based Basin Electric Power Cooperative has been broadening its generation portfolio. Basin used to use primarily coal to generate power. Now
we're probably only about 45% coal, and the rest is wind and gas, basically.
Basin General Manager Paul Sukut says one of the reasons for that is the load growth the co-op has seen over the past 10 years.
That growth, we served it by building wind and gas.
Sukut says by the end of 2019, Basin will have 1,700 megawatts of wind generation, and he says Basin has 550 megawatts of natural gas peaking plants in the Bakken. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by John Ford Dunker. John joins us from his apartment in Brooklyn, New York, and we're going to talk about an adventure he had on stage. John, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your dad works upstairs here at Prairie Public. He is the business development manager for the system that I work for. And there was an excited email that went around the place about your appearance with the Conan O'Brien show at the Apollo Theater in New York, in Harlem. Tell us basically your background. How did you get to New York? And then we'll get into the show.
Yeah. So I started doing theater in Fargo when I was 11 years old. I did a number of shows at FMCT. Also was involved at Gooseberry and Trollwood Performing Arts School, and a lot of the opportunities that we have around town. And ended up going to school in Wisconsin at the University of Wisconsin in Stevens Point. Studied musical theater there. And right after I got out of there, I did an acting apprenticeship at Actors Theater of Louisville in Kentucky, and that was a 9-month program, and I landed in New York right after that, so summer of 2015. So I've been out here about 2.5 years now.
Well, let's talk about this Conan gig. How did you get the gig?
Well, I've been very lucky to have been working with some agents this year for the first time, and the way they do things, sometimes you'll get an audition, you know, for a play or a musical or something, and you'll go into a room and do an audition in sort of the classic sense. They also do what are called online submissions, which is something, you know, if it's for a commercial or in this case, you know, a late night television sketch, there may not be an audition involved. It's sort of a new trend in the business that's been kind of developing, where, you know, if you're an actor and, you know, you also have other stuff you do on the side, like I do, like I write music and sort of produce content in that area. And, you know, I have that online in some different areas. And so then my agent can submit that as well. So the casting at Conan basically reviewed some of my, some of my songs and content that I had online, and thought I would be a good fit. And the rest was history.
Well, who wrote the sketch?
The sketch, oh man, I'm blanking on their names. There's two writers on the show, or there's more than two. There's a lot of writers running around, but two of the in-house writers that they sort of write all the sketches, and sometimes they're in the sketches too.
And how long did you work on it? What kind of rehearsal period did you have?
Well, we had a very short actual rehearsal period, yeah. But we had to be at the Apollo all day this past Sunday. Doing fittings for costumes, and we did a little bit of a music rehearsal in that time. But then, you know, we were there 10 to 6 on Sunday. Most of that's just kind of waiting around, seeing what the schedule's going to be, you know, because it changes up to the last minute. And then we continued to rehearse and tweak different things on Tuesday, but that was kind of a similar holding pattern, sort of backstage in the green room there. Kind of a lot of hurry up and wait, and then, all right, here we go. So it felt like it was a long time, but it also felt like it went by very quickly.
Well, let's give our listeners a taste of what it sounded like. We've got a clip from the sketch that was performed on the Conan O'Brien show, and I'll even use the sentence that Conan used to kind of set it up. It's a musical about the life of Samuel Adams that critics are already calling another musical about a founding father.
Of the Apollo. This is a story that you got to follow.
Of a patriot statesman, founding father and brewer, a rebel and a rabble-rouser, thinker and doer.
Never forget all you sirs and madams, a founding father by the name of Sam Adams.
I'm a Boston OG, Harvard educated smarty, stuck into the British with the Boston Tea Party. I designed the America you all hold dear, but even more important, I invented beer.
He invented beer!
Wait a minute. Stop the music. I know history pretty well. Sam Adams didn't invent beer.
No. And Conan was out on stage with you there. Did he rehearse with you as well?
He did. He did sort of in our last rehearsal that we did, because as you would think, you know, he has a lot of other things going on that he's working on. So he and Andy kind of got put in sort of last minute. But it was cool. Yeah, it was fun to interact with them. They're both extremely, extremely nice people, and everyone working on the show and everyone that was in the building was just so nice and warm and normal. I think that's important to emphasize. So it was a great team to work with.
And I'll tell our listeners that the very first voice you heard in that clip we played was you, John Ford Dunker. You're wearing a powdered white wig, and you're rapping with a young woman. You're all in period costume. It's a takeoff on Hamilton, of course, and probably a takeoff on Sam Adams, the beer manufacturer.
That's right.
Had you worked with the other performers before?
I had not worked with any of them before. They all had a very similar story to me in terms of how they got involved. It was, you know, something that an agent or manager or someone had either submitted for them online, or they had done it themselves, and it went from there. Some of them had been on the show. Conan did a week at the Apollo last year. Some of them had been on that show, and they were having them back. So hopefully maybe it'll be a seasonal occurrence. We'll see.
Well, what's it like to perform on stage of the very well-known Apollo Theater in Harlem?
I mean, it was incredible. I mean, the first thing, you know, you walk in backstage and all the hallways and everything back there are all signed by all the performers that have performed there over the years, you know, anything from, you know, contemporary acts that perform there now, but I mean, all the way back, you know, I mean, Ella Fitzgerald performed there, you know, and all kinds of people. So to sort of be on that stage, you can kind of feel a lot of other people in the room, even though they're not there, if you know what I'm saying, but it just to kind of be a part of the history. Another really interesting thing too is, you know, the cameras they use and sort of the way they shoot things, they make all these places seem really big. And they're
yeah.
really not.
Yes.
They're really not. I mean, it was really intimate house, really kind of cramped backstage. And it was kind of interesting to see how they sort of pull off that magic, especially in such a historical space.
Well, I imagine it's a wide-angle lens.
yeah, definitely.
Well, John Stewart was on the show the night you were there. Did you get to meet him?
We didn't meet him personally. He was around. He was kind of hanging out in the green room and stuff. You know, sometimes when you're in a situation like that, when, you know, someone comes in, especially, you know, and they're there with their manager and their agent and their people and everything, it's not really a circumstance where you waltz up to them and say hello, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Bill Clinton was on the next day. You know, it's sort of like you kind of got to gauge, you know, where you have to like keep your distance and stuff. But it was the main thing was kind of just cool to work on an episode of something, you know, with someone like Jon Stewart and Conan and Keegan-Michael Key and everyone else that was there. It was just sort of, I mean, that was cool enough for me. I had no agenda of meeting anyone or taking any selfies or anything like that. I was just grateful to be there.
Well, two great comedians, Jon Stewart and Keegan-Michael Key, and you were in the green room. You mentioned that. Our listeners may not know that that's where you wait before you go on stage. How's their green room?
It's really nice. I mean, it's it sounds weird to say that, but I mean, it's just kind of a basic room that has like some couches and some folding chairs, and there's a catering company that comes in and provides, you know, snacks and coffee and stuff throughout the day. The part of the Conan crew costume shop was kind of taking up half the green room, so it was kind of a split space. It was kind of interesting to see how a company, you know, from the West Coast or someplace else comes in and inhabits someone else's space. That was really interesting to see, but I mean, if there's free coffee on hand, I'm a happy camper.
Well, when you're not performing at the Apollo and the Conan O'Brien show, or writing some music and, you know, some online stuff, how do you sustain yourself in New York City?
Well, I mean, I do a number of things. For a long time, I did catering, which I still do here and there. A friend of mine works for a catering company, and was definitely a blessing to sort of get set up with that company right when I arrived here. I had a job right away, and it's also really flexible, so it allows you to audition and such. Recently, for about the past 6 months or so while I've been here, I've been working at a great restaurant called Westville. There's a number of them around the city. It sounds weird, but I actually really enjoy working there. It's not usually the case with actors doing serving jobs, but they've got a really great team and great culture there. So doing a food service things primarily. I've worked in retail. I've done some temp work for some different companies. It's sort of kind of wherever you can get the most flexible hours, and that's going to make it work for your schedule. I've been pretty blessed this year to have a pretty good amount of acting work, I guess, relatively speaking. So it's been a, you know, and to cap it off with something like Conan, has been really great, but I've been pretty lucky this year actually in terms of income from some acting things as well, but, always great to have other job opportunities, around town kind of as a safety net.
And now a kid from the Upper Great Plains is living in Brooklyn, New York, which is an ethnic mix, the like of which, what's your neighborhood like?
Well, you know, it's changing. I've lived in this neighborhood for about a year and a half now, and it's changing pretty rapidly. You know, a lot of people may not know this, but you know, gentrification is definitely like an issue in the city. Sometimes it's hard to not feel like you're a part of that, you know, sometimes I have some conflicting feelings about it, but my neighborhood right now is pretty mixed, and it's pretty quiet too. It's very different from uptown New York where I used to live, where, I mean, you have a lot more hustle and bustle, a lot more stuff going on. My neighborhood's a little quieter. But it's good. I like Brooklyn. Brooklyn has its ups and downs. So does Manhattan. You know, you kind of, it's sort of a mixed bag wherever you go. But the neighborhood's good. I like it.
Well, John Ford Dunker, what is your dream job now that you've been on the stage at the Apollo and performed for Conan O'Brien?
Oh man. You know, I guess it's kind of a cliche, I think, and I think it's changed a little bit. You know, a lot of actors say they want to work on Broadway and, you know, or be in movies and everything like that. And I feel like where those maybe used to be sort of end goals, those have sort of moved to more sort of stepping stone goals. It's like those things are great, you know, and they pay the bills for a while, but there's really the reality of those jobs is actually a lot different than I think a lot of people realize. And I definitely want to keep doing those things, but I would love to get to a point where I can, you know, be well enough off to maybe start backing some projects and maybe producing some things. You know, I have a lot of friends who are writers, who are great writers, you know, that are writing plays and TV series and stuff like that. And there's a lot of great projects going on in the city that are really important that are allowing a lot of voices to be heard that aren't normally heard, but there's not a lot of money to sort of support that work and make it sustainable for actors. And since I've had a number of experiences where I've been on the acting end of that and, you know, have, you know, completely run out of money basically, but doing a passion project, you know, I was sort of like, something's broken here, you know? So definitely something that I want to do down the road is be able to sort of give back to that community. support the work of others. So that's definitely a big dream right now.
Well, right now you've got something very good on your reel to show around if you need another performing job.
That's right.
John Ford Dunker is an actor living in Brooklyn, New York, and he just recently appeared on the Conan O'Brien Show in the parody of a musical based on the life of Sam Adams. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
More Main Street in a moment.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Dakota Stage of Bismarck invites you to step back in time to the golden age of radio at the live performance of It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play, November 30th through December 2nd and December 7th through the 10th. Enjoy a live retelling of the classic holiday story by a team of 1940s radio personalities. Tickets and information online at dakotastageltd.com or by calling 701-258-4998.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Larry Speakermeyer. He joins us by telephone from Missoula, Montana. Larry is driving the transport truck that will carry the nation's capital Christmas tree from northwest Montana to Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us, Larry.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Has the tree been selected?
Yes, it has.
Well, how big? How big a tree do we have this year?
Well, the tree started out at 80-some feet, and the length they want it, when it gets to the Capitol, it will be 68 feet. So that's what we have, is a 68-foot tree on the trailer right now.
That's a pretty big tree. Do you have any sense of how much it weighs?
About 12,000 pounds.
And how is it transported? You're going to be driving a big Kenworth semi, a big 18-wheeler. What kinds of preparations do you have to make on a tree this size to get it safely to where it's going to be set up?
They have sides that they put on the tree, and some of them are plexiglass, so you can see the tree. But we fold it up like you would get a regular Christmas tree, so we can get it down to 8'6" wide.
Wow.
And try to get it down to 13'6" tall. So it's all contained in this trailer. But the trailer is, I'll be 102 feet long. The trailer's 80-foot trailer.
So do you have accompaniment? Do you have pilot cars or something with you as you do make this drive?
I have two Forest Service Ranger escorts, plus each state is providing Highway Patrol escort across there. And then whenever we get to an event in a city, then local police and sheriff's department will escort us there.
So you'll be driving from Montana through North Dakota on your way to Washington, D.C. Where will you be stopping in the state?
We have an event in Dickinson, North Dakota. and I believe that's on Thursday. And then we go to Grand Forks, North Dakota for the evening, and we have an event then the next morning in Grand Forks. And then on my way back south at Fargo, there's a Love's truck stop, and we will stop there for fuel and a little quick stop. And then we have to be in Browns Valley shortly after dinner for an event there in Browns Valley, Minnesota.
So this is quite the trip you're making. Have you done this before?
Nope. A once-in-a-lifetime thing.
So how did you get selected, Larry?
Choose Outdoors, who is sponsoring kind of this whole program, contacted the Motor Carriers of Montana to find out a trucking company and people that might be interested in taking care of this. And they got a hold of the company I work for, Whitewood Transport. And between Motor Carriers of Montana and Whitewood Transport, they selected me to navigate the truck.
Well, I saw the press release, and it probably picked you because you've got 1.7 million accident-free miles.
Yes, I do.
How long does it take to get that kind of a record?
I've been driving for Whitewood Transport for the last almost 19 years. Hmm. And my career is right now at 49 and a half years of driving truck. That's when I started in North Dakota.
And you're a Castleton native, yeah?
I'm at 3.5 million miles without an accident.
Wow.
I'm 1.6 million with this company that I've been working for.
I think I'm about 80,000 miles from the last one. Is there a record for this kind of safety performance?
I don't know. I mean, there is people that probably have as good a record as this, you know, also. But our company, Whitewood Transport, has an awesome safety record. And I guess it's the drivers that we have there that make this work.
Well, you'll be driving 2,000 miles about from this tree was picked up in northwest Montana, the Kootenai Forest, and you're driving across all these states. How long is it going to take you?
The tour will be starting on the 13th of November, and we will be setting the tree in place in the Capitol on the 27th of November. So we have about
2 weeks,
days or so. Yeah.
Okay.
And the trip is 3,600 miles.
Oh, wow. I underestimated it. But you're zigzagging a bit, I take it.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. What kind of mileage does a Kenworth semi get when it's hauling a heavy load?
We are not really so heavy, but the way this truck looks like it's working, we're probably going to be in the 7 mile to the gallon class.
Okay. Well, very good. And why is Whitewood Transport such an avid sponsor of the Capital Christmas Tree program?
We were asked by the Motor Carriers of Montana, who was asked by Choose Outdoors, and we just thought it would be a good place to get recognition for all the people and the driving records the company has, and it turned out that way. I think it's going to be a good program.
Well, thank you for sharing your adventure with us.
Yes. So anybody in North Dakota country, we have two spots, two and a half spots, because it'll be a short one in Fargo, but the Grand Forks and the Dickinson one, definitely come and see us.
Okay, Thursday in Dickinson, the next day in Grand Forks. Have a great trip, Larry.
Okay, thank you much.
Larry Speakermeyer is the Capital Christmas Tree driver for Whitewood Transport. He spoke to us from Missoula, Montana. More Main Street in a moment.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. You're listening, so you must like us, so you probably want to know all the ways you can listen. You can listen on the radio. Traditionally, you can be a modern and load the Prairie Public app on your smartphone or tablet. You can be cosmopolitan and use TuneIn or iHeartRadio, or maybe you want to be a hipster. You can listen to NPR One. However you like to listen, we're glad to have you.
This is Dakota Daybook for November 13th. Returning soldiers face challenges when they leave the service. This has long been a concern. In 1776, the Continental Congress authorized pensions for disabled veterans, and in 1827, a hospital called the Naval Asylum was the first effort to provide continuing medical care. President Lincoln, in his second inaugural address, called upon the nation to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan. World War I spawned the Vocational Rehabilitation Act of 1918, recognizing that veterans of World War I faced substantial challenges. Any honorably discharged disabled veteran was eligible for vocational rehabilitation training. On this date in 1919, the North Dakota Agricultural College in Fargo announced that returning veterans should not hesitate to apply to the school. The school realized that disabled veterans were not the only ones who needed assistance. Able-bodied veterans would need jobs, and the NDAC said the returned soldier is anxious to prepare himself in some trade or profession. The school felt that veterans could bring important skills to agriculture and would help improve farming methods. Veterans had been exposed to new ways of doing things, both in the training camps and in their travels, generating fresh ideas about better livestock, improving soil quality, introducing new crops, and adjusting crop rotation to increase yields. The war had also clearly demonstrated the adaptability of power equipment, which was poised to revolutionize agriculture. To help veterans put their ideas into practice, the NDAC touted its courses in animal husbandry, draftsmanship, construction, and power machinery. The school even promised to assist with financing until the veterans started receiving military benefits. Today, there is even more awareness of the challenges faced by veterans with programs available like free health and wellness services. Job search websites often highlight opportunities for returning soldiers, and a number of industries have even created jobs designed specifically for the nation's veterans. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
A young man named Andrew Anglin was in his teens when he began hurting himself, and an adult when he began hurting others online.
He created this army, thousands of angry young men all gathering together online to plot anti-Semitic harassment campaigns, if not violent insurrection.
I'm Steve Inskeep, the origins of an American Nazi, on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, we'll talk with Joel Peterson, whose interest in unmanned aircraft systems first led him to a Hollywood career, then to North Dakota. His drones fly missions to check on safety and operations in the oil patch. So we'll talk with him about that. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.